Welcome to Heartland Darkland. I'm Cassie.
And I'm Shannon.
Hey, Dark Hearts.
Welcome. Here we go. Another week. We're on a roll with not being on a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Two weeks in a row. Listen, you guys, we had audio issues, recording issues. So, like, this is opening part two for us. Like, we had had a whole chat. It was only 5 minutes in, but, you know, technical difficulties. I know. So
Browser error? What does that even mean?
Like, I have no
Get it together,
idea.
Google. Get it yeah. together.
So, you know, we chit-chatted. I mean, it was probably the universe being like, no one cares that you guys are happy about spring. Just
yeah, nobody gives a shit. We all are aware of shooting the shit with the weather. It's always the go-to, you know. So on that note, I'm just going to go back to where I was and just
We're just
going to
dive right in. Yeah, we're just
going
to dive
literally,
in this week, you guys.
We're going to dive into my story because... You see what you did there? Mm-hmm. This week, trending in the news. Actually, I don't know if it's trending. It just sounded like a very newscaster thing to say. But the case that I found was pretty wild. So police confirm car linked to nearly 42-year-old case of three missing men. So turns out in Washington, North Carolina, police found this car in a creek, which apparently a creek can be up to 15 feet deep. We just found out. So to me, I think of a tiny little
that's
thing.
A river. I wonder if it was a creek and then like
maybe,
maybe over time it got deeper and they just never renamed it.
And it's still just, what did I say with Jack's Creek? Yeah. So, and I don't know what spawned these people to even look here because this news article and a couple I read never really says, which I guess it doesn't matter necessarily because of what they found is end game anyways. So they found this Camaro, a 1975 Camaro, in the bottom of this creek. It was so corroded and rusted out that, like, it was only really pieces of the car. They could piece together that that's what it was. But it belonged to Bill Clifton and also two of his friends, David McKicken and Michael Norman, were also in that car with him. So these guys had gone to a bar in... I just want to say the name of this town because it's fun. Chocowinity is what it says.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So December 10th, 1982, these three guys went to a bar, left, and were never seen again. So nobody really knew what happened. And then they found this vehicle that belonged to one of them. And they were able to match the VIN number and the license plate after they had to scrape off all this crap. They said they had to use like a screwdriver, a hammer, all kinds of things. And just to match them. They did find human remains. Obviously, we don't know yet for sure if it's them. And plus, they said they're going to have to try to find living relatives of these men to kind of go from there and see if they can even make a match of what they, with what they have. But they said originally when they first saw this in the car, they thought that it was like an old lawnmower or something because it was that badly like corroded that it doesn't like, it didn't even look like a vehicle.
Oh, geez.
It was only like the drivetrain and the frame remaining. So
I get that it's like
wild.
40 some years, but at the same time, I'm like, how bad is that water that ate away?
That's what I was thinking. And I'm
like that.
And Camaros are like known for being good cars, right? I mean, more of a muscle car, but like.
But still, especially built, it was in the 70s car,
82.
Right?
But the car was a 75. Yeah.
So that's still got your solid metal, which I understand. But if it's not salt water.
Right.
I mean, you have all those, like, you have ships from
1700
in the ocean that are wood.
Titanic is still going strong down there, kind of. With that pressure and stuff, too. Water pressure. But I guess in a creek, maybe it's not as much if it's that deep. But still, pretty wild. So
that's...
Yeah. So I'm...
It's kind of ironic that you picked a cold case that was solved many years later and that it was an 82 because that's like my
route we're going. Oh my gosh.
But before I talk about that,
enlighten us.
I will. But before I go into it, I did Google a creek. The difference between a creek and a river isn't the depth, it's the width, like how much bank they have.
So it could just be a, like, I think of like a ditch. Like,
right. Like, you know, like the tiny little, yeah. So, but apparently it can be super deep, but just not very wide.
Deep and wide, deep and wide. Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah. Just wow.
That little fun fact for you.
That is a fun fact. I enjoy that. So, okay.
So now we know.
Pretty crazy. I was like, you don't hear stuff like that happening often, I guess. So
no. And like I said, it's kind of funny because mine is actually a cold case that was solved 25 years later. So I'm kind of giving, you know, that away a little bit. But it's also like, okay, so that's ironic. And because then the year we start with is 82. There are so many dates.
Yep. There.
There's also so many dates that like link back to me. Like there are dates around my birthday, on my birthday, my daughter's birthday, and my mom's birthday.
Oh, that's weird.
Just obviously different years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. But before I dive into this case, I do want to give trigger warnings. There's going to be a lot of talk of like sexual assault in today's episode, and rape. I'm obviously not going to go into graphic details, but still, I know that can be very triggering for some people. So if that's something that's hard for you to listen to, like, please skip this week's episode, come back next week. Your mental health is important. And so I just wanted to give that right out the front, just so everyone's aware.
Thanks.
This is a little difficult. I did also watch Cold Case Files on Netflix for this, and that's going to be in the show notes. I briefly started Killer Profiles on Amazon, which I did the free trial because you have to have the A&E add-on.
Yeah. I hate when they have all that stuff. I know. Like, just put it on here and make it simple for me.
I know. I did the free trial, but I only got a few minutes in, and it was just like very monotone in the way they were talking. And then like you could tell they were going to do like reenactments, and I was like, no.
We're not
like,
doing that. Thanks.
Nope. So I did skip that, but I am still going to put that in the show notes in case anyone else wants to, because it sounds like they included different details than the cold case and stuff. And yeah. So, I'll kind of get into things as we go, because otherwise I'm just going to start to get confusing.
Yep. Nope. You are good.
So for this week's episode, we are actually going to kind of be jumping around to a few different states, but we're starting in Carbondale, Illinois, and the main case I'm talking about will be from there. So that's what's going to be like on the episode headline and stuff. So yeah, we're kind of just instant into it. You know, we're not easing into this today, you guys. So on the morning of April 9th, 1982, so 6 years before I was born, the family of 23-year-old Deborah Shepherd, who was a senior at Southern Illinois University, received word that their daughter had been found dead in her apartment the evening before. She was just 2 weeks away from graduating with her marketing degree, and her family was actually supposed to be heading to see her that morning. See, they lived in the suburbs of Chicago, which was about 5 hours away, so they were going to come visit her for Easter weekend.
Oh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, minus what I got from the Cold Case Files show, I don't know too much about Deborah prior to this, except that she was born on December 10th. 1958 in Chicago. She had two younger sisters, Bridget and Nicole. Her sister Bridget was on the show talking about her. They interviewed her. Their mom is mentioned, but I'm not 100% sure like if the parents were still together, if mom was around a ton, or if dad had main custody, because the pictures they then show are like the daughters and the dad. Hmm. And mom's name is never said. But the dad is Bernie Shepherd. So, see, the other thing that made me question, and not that it truly matters, but, like, Bridget also mentioned in the show that Deborah was, like, a mother to her. So, mm-hmm. losing her wasn't just losing a sister. It was losing her mother in a way, too. Oh,
yeah.
So, that's where I was, like, I don't know, you know. But overall, it sounds like Deborah had a really happy life, a happy family. I don't know the exact age gap between Bridget and Deborah, but it sounds like there was like a bit of a gap, you know. I believe Bridget was a teenager and Deborah was 23, so I think Bridget was like 16 or so a bit of an age gap,
so she could see her as a mother. I mean, more just like that older sister taking
care of her. Yeah, but Deborah was beautiful, kind, loving. She was just friends with everyone. Like, she was beautiful inside and out, which obviously there'll be pictures of her. But I mean, she was friends with everyone. So on the evening of April 8th of 1982, Deborah's boyfriend Randy asked her to go see a movie. However, she declined because her family was coming the next day. She had a lot of things she wanted to get done before they came over to her apartment. So even knowing this, Randy decided he's going to stop by, just to, like, say hi, talk to her for a bit, you know, whatever. I would hope maybe help her clean or something.
Yeah, but, for sure. that would be nice.
Right. So when he got to her apartment, he noticed a note on her door saying, "I'm in the shower, knock loudly." So I don't know if, like, she knew he was coming over or just in case, like, she knew sometimes people would just stop by, you know, I don't know, mm-hmm. because you got to think there's no cell phones, right? They can't just call right. you. And if you're in the shower, like, they don't have a cell phone to call right. you.
And portable, like, cordless phones weren't even a thing then where you could just bring that phone.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, like, I know there were, like, cell phones, but they're like, they weren't, they were those big clunky things with bags or whatever.
Yeah, did they even have those? This is the '80s, right?
This is the '80s.
Yeah, I don't think they even had those in the '80s.
I think they did.
Pagers, maybe, but
no, I think they still had them because I'm thinking of 16 Candles. Like, they had the car cell phone and stuff too, like the car phone. And that movie was from the '80s. Like,
yeah, I think it was. I remember my parents had one, but we were like, I want to say it was like 90s, like mid-90s.
I feel like the ones in the 80s were like rich white corporate men who had them. You know, it was not.
And it was like cost $1 billion to even get the call on it type thing.
Yeah.
But they existed, but nonetheless, nobody would have them really unless you were somebody big and important.
Exactly. Definitely not college students.
No, no.
So, anyways. So he goes in, right? And the door's unlocked. So he walked in, goes back to her bedroom, and he finds her lying nude on her bedroom floor, deceased. So he runs to a friend's apartment. I don't know if it was in the same building. Like, they don't give a ton of details on that. But he calls 911, and EMTs come, and they determine she's dead. But they can't find any wounds or abnormalities on her body. Except when they roll her over to, like, I'm assuming to, like, get her onto the gurney and stuff, foamy blood spills out of her mouth.
Oh.
Yes. Which will come in, which they showed pictures of, which, I mean, it wasn't super graphic, but to me it was like, ugh.
Even just knowing in the manner that someone, nobody wants to see those things. Or
no.
Their family that way.
No. So detectives are there. They take pictures of everything. They take a picture of the blood that spilled from her mouth, which also landed on a purple t-shirt that was lying under her. That was hers. So they actually take that into evidence. Remember that for later. But they notice that her phone in her bedroom, the cord is cut, and the glass part of her window to her bedroom is off and laying in the grass outside. So they figured this is the point of entry. The problem is there's nothing missing. And they can't find any visible wounds on her.
That's odd. So she just, like, left the door unlocked for her boyfriend, though, you think? I mean,
I see, and that's what they didn't give a ton of, like, information. Yeah. So I don't know if she was, like,
people are more trusting back then, too. Like, he's coming, I'll just leave the door open. Well, but it doesn't really matter, I guess, if someone came through the window anyway.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
but I guess they talk about in the show, like, how safe Carbondale is and how people from Northern Illinois would send their kids there thinking it's safe, you know, this is supposed to be such a safe place, right?
Oh, yeah. And so, in the '80s, people were just, like, more trusting.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so,
yeah.
Wow, though, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, Randy is questioned, and Bridget mentions in the show that, like, they'd been friends first and then they were romantic, but that Deborah was, like, trying to slow down the relationship a bit. But Randy's alibi is solid, and he seemed genuinely distressed. Like, everything seemed genuine in his 911 call, his reactions. Like, so they have no connection. Like, they can't connect him to her death. So they do also do a rape kit, but again, it's 1982, so we don't have DNA, right? Like, they are just looking to see if there's any foreign hairs, fluid, blood, semen, that kind of stuff, right? So they do that. That, again, takes forever, too. But they perform an autopsy And it sounds like it was there in Carbondale. The coroner finds pulmonary edema, which is what caused that frothy blood in her mouth. Okay. But he rules her death being due to natural causes because he can't find anything else wrong with her. And they hold a press conference and they're like, this was natural causes.
What?
Like, no worries. And now something to note.
I mean,
that
is weird, though, I think, too. I mean, like, it'd be hard to say, like, someone did do this when there's not a sign of that kind of thing. But
right. Well, but then also, so it's worth noting, Deborah is a Black woman.
Okay.
And so it's 1982.
Well, that does make a difference, unfortunately.
And so
don't care as much.
Yeah. So her family, especially her dad, felt like they were just sweeping this under the rug because of her skin color and because it's a small, safe community that they didn't, and they didn't want to scare people. So they didn't want to push it, right? So they're just like, no, well.
That's BS.
Yeah. Fortunately for Deborah, her dad, like Bridget goes on about how much their father loved them. He would do anything for their children. So he drives the 5 hours to Carbondale and insists on bringing her body back home to Chicago and giving another autopsy done.
Good for him.
Yes. So then the coroner finds deep bruising on her neck. And I'm assuming like in the muscles on the inside, because like I'm assuming they didn't see them. Or again, you have a coroner who deals with mainly white people
and doesn't know,
isn't used to looking at different skin types.
Which is fair too. I mean, that's probably...
I would think if you're going to be a coroner to make official homicide or not investigations, you should be better than
It's still something. And knowing that it's, you know, bruising would show up maybe differently. Like maybe you would take that extra step at the, at that time too. Like,
yeah. So
okay, maybe
not,
you don't know, but
yeah. So they don't go into full detail on like, was this bruising found internally or was it like, this is a person who it shouldn't have their job, maybe, if they can't determine what bruising looks like on different skin types.
Touche. Yes. And in the 80s, still, like, I'm sorry, it's not like this is a brand new job, and like crime is like, not a new thing in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. So either way, this coroner's like, yeah, no, she died due to strangulation.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, more so when you talk about the blood in the mouth and stuff, but
yeah. And so then the rape kit comes back, and on the oral swab, which, just FYI, oral means from the mouth, they found semen. But then they're like, okay,
they can't test it really, right? Because
we don't have DNA.
Yeah, they just know that there was a male there.
At this point, it's like they can determine, like, I think blood type and like a few things, but they're like, hey, there was semen. Cool.
Yeah. So now we just know that there is more to this attack, but
exactly. So she was sexually assaulted, unfortunately, and killed. Now, their next suspect is actually Deborah's roommate, who was a male. She had a male roommate named Anthony. Now, her dad obviously was not thrilled with this. She'd had female roommates prior, but unfortunately they moved and she needed help, and her friend was like, "Hey, I will move in." And she's like, cool, I need help with rent. I know my dad's going to hate this, but
they're just friends anyway, so,
right?
It's
help.
Not like it's, yeah.
Yes. Well, so a friend did tell police that Anthony tried to kiss Deborah, and she rejected him. However, when they interview him, like, he was at work, and his alibi checks out. There's proof he was there. So, like, nope, it wasn't him.
Well, good. So that would be shitty, even more shitty as a parent. Like, I knew I didn't want this, and this is why, but.
Mm-hmm. So then, because Carbondale is like a smaller town vibes, I get, like, even though there's a college there, it sounds like it's fairly small town. So they ask the FBI to come in and do a suspect profile, which this is gaining a lot of traction at this time. You know, they're getting this a lot. So the FBI profile, this is what they say the suspect is. So keep this in mind, too. The killer is most likely African-American, around her age, and someone she knows.
I would love to know why they think African-American. What do they have? Anything, any sort of evidence to imply that? Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But okay.
But, yep. So with this information, her dad questions all of her friends and like insists they take lie detector tests. And the thing is every single one of her friends agrees because they loved her. They want to know what happens and they all pass it. So unfortunately, a year passes and there's no new leads until across town, like still in Carbondale, another young woman is raped. And the scene is familiar with the window being removed and the phone cord being cut. And actually, the perpetrator in this case turned out to be a friend of Deborah's, whose fingerprint, it turns out, they actually found on the window at her apartment, which I'm like, when they brought that up then, I was like, how did we not
cover that earlier?
Unless he had no record prior. And so then when he got arrested for this, they took his fingerprints and they were like, hey, but they should have explained that a little better.
Yeah, because otherwise it sounds like they were just sloppy and really didn't try.
Yeah, well, because in the show, too, the way they worded this case, they made it sound like the victim was her friend at first. And then it wasn't until they were talking, I was like, oh, no, the perpetrator. Because the thing is, too, is it turns out he admitted to being there after her body was found, but leaving before the police got there. And so then that makes me wonder if he was like, got the idea for his assault. He's like, well, I saw they went in through the window and they cut the phone cord. So that was, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, did he take ideas?
Gross. Like copycat style.
Yeah. Sure. Except the thing is like he had an alibi for where he was during her attack and it checks out.
So how does his print get from her place to this? Or how do they know that he's the perp at this other one? Or did you say that?
I'm assuming. See, and I didn't go into detail, but I'm assuming because the woman in that one survived. So I'm assuming she ID'd him.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you when you said identical. I was like, wait, did she also die? So she was assaulted, but not
killed. She was raped, but it doesn't sound like she was killed. So I'm assuming she identified. Again, like, this was one thing about Cold Case. Like, they didn't go into, like, I feel like they left some details out. Because then there's some other stuff I'll get into later that they said, but then I don't know. Okay. Anyways, so unfortunately, by 1984, the Carbondale Police Department would shelve her case as a cold case. So So this brings us to something else. So what they were unaware of was that just 50
months.
So sorry. You're fine. It happens. So what they were unaware of was that just 50 miles away in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, on January 26th of 1982. So see, that's where my daughter's birthday, January 26th.
Oh, yeah. That is weird.
Right? 10 weeks before Deborah's murder, 57-year-old Margie Call got off of work, went out with her card club, which I think is the most adorable thing ever. And Margie's white, okay? So this is the thing I'm going to come back to. Like, the victims in this are all varied. So she gets off
of work. What about the second victim? Did you ever say, sorry, was she white?
Yes, this one, Margie Call. Oh, the other one. She wasn't a victim of the same perpetrator.
Oh, that was just, so it doesn't matter as much. But okay.
Yeah, so I have no idea. They just said this woman was raped. Okay. That's all I know.
Since it's separate, yeah, that makes sense.
Yep, so it was a completely separate thing. It was a red herring. So Margie Call went to her card night with her friends, and then they always followed her home because, again, this is a small town, small community. So her friends would follow her home, and when she got inside, she turned on her porch light to let them know that she was safe.
Okay.
Because Margie, I mean, it's adorable. So Margie was a widow because her husband had passed away of a heart attack in 1978. So she lived all alone in their house, you know, so her friends were looking out for her. But on January 27th, when Margie failed to show up for work, which she worked at like a place called Woolworths, and she had worked there for 42 years as a bookkeeper. So obviously her coworkers know how reliable she is. So they become concerned and they call her brother. So her brother goes to her house to check on her. And when he enters, he finds her naked, except for a pair of black calf-high boots, face down on her bed with her hands tied behind her back. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Ugh. So when police get there, they find that her bathroom window had been broken, and they found a cord similar to that had been tied around her hands in her bathroom. So her son Don was interviewed on Cold Case Files, and he talked about how, like, she was friends with everyone, she got along with everyone, she didn't date. You know, she kind of kept the same routine. And they did find out in the course of, like, trying to look into possible leads that, like, she'd been in the hospital prior for something and an orderly there harassed her. That's all they say. Now, her son, Don, is like, I don't know if that was groping, touching her inappropriately, or doing something. I'm like, that, I would hope that would have gotten this man fired.
Right.
Even like, in the
80s. Like, it's not a big deal because, yeah, that's frowned upon no matter what year that is.
Yeah. So they don't actually tell us what harassing her means. But apparently he still worked at the hospital because they go there to interview him. And he has an alibi. So that's it. That was the only lead they had, and 6 months go by with no leads. And then on June 21st of 1982, which is my sister's birthday.
That is really weird.
I know. God. In the same town, just 5 blocks away from Margie Call's house, 67-year-old Mildred Wallace is found deceased in her bedroom. She's blindfolded. Hands are tied behind her back and she's naked. She was obviously sexually assaulted. She is also a white woman. Her bathroom window had been broken as well. And the Cape Girardeau detective who was on this case, he believed it was the same killer, even though there is one difference. And that was that Mildred had been shot in the head.
Oh.
But despite that, he still thinks that these are linked.
Okay. That's interesting. I wonder why the change of... Okay.
So, unfortunately, they had no suspects in her case. And this town is freaking out because you've now have two women. They were only 5 blocks away from each other. Like, they talk about how, like, gun sales went up. Husbands didn't want their wives going out alone and things like that. But by 1985... 3 years after their murders, so they got one extra year than Deborah got of them trying to, like, keep the case open.
Yeah.
They shelved their cases as having gone cold as well. So that seems to be it, right? Like, they've got no new leads, they have nothing. Until we come to May of 2006, where a chance interview brings attention back to Deborah's case. See, and it's funny. So, like, when I started watching Cold Case, they interviewed the detective from Carbondale. And I was like, his name was Paul Eccles. And I was like, that name sounds so familiar. Yeah, they had actually interviewed him for another Cold Case file.
Oh.
Because Paul Eccles, he was being interviewed about the for an episode about the 1981 murder of another SIU student. So this was just a year prior. In 1981, another college student had been murdered. And I'm like, how are we trying to say that this town is super safe?
Yeah, it's clearly where not. Did we get that idea? Because I'm not going there.
Yeah. So this was Susan Schumach, whose case went cold until 2004 when Eccles solved it with DNA. So while Cold Case Files is there interviewing him, they have a DNA expert there named Suzanne Kidd. So he asks her during it, he's like, hey, like, we still have some of this stuff from Deborah's case. Like, would you look at it? And she's like, yes. But his captain is like, no, you can't pull that because I guess he was like the midnight like traffic stop police officer. I don't know exactly. And they're like, no, you have to focus on that. Like, okay.
Yeah, that sounds super important.
Yeah.
Big deal but, about this dead person, but okay.
Yeah. But I guess a year later, he gets a promotion to lieutenant, and he then is like a detective or something. I don't know. I didn't follow that fully. It doesn't matter. He finally gets to pull the case in 2007. So that purple t-shirt is important because Suzanne is like, hey, we found semen on this because the one that they had, the semen sample they had from the oral swab wasn't enough. Like, it didn't have enough to, like, test. This did. So I guess you have to it had like 9 of the, I don't know how many markers. Like, you have to have at least 9 of these things to check it. So on August 9th of 2007, 25 years after the sexual assault and murder of Deborah Shepherd, they put it in the system and they actually find a match. It is a 63-year-old white man named Timothy, I'm going to say his name wrong. I don't care because he's an asshole. Kreischer. It's K-R-A-J-C-I-R. They said his name. I didn't. Yeah.
Yep. Irrelevant.
Yep.
Piece of shit.
Yep. So he's white and he actually didn't know Deborah.
So not an acquaintance and not a African-American male, as they all had described.
Yep. Yep. The only thing they had right is I think he would have been like close to her age-ish.
At the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to give a brief rundown on him. You can find a lot more information online, but like, fuck him. So
yeah, we don't care actually.
No. So he was from Pennsylvania. It sounds like as a teen, like young adult and teenager, like he got into some shit, but then he joined the Navy when he was 18. And then he was stationed in Chicago, where an article I read said he was married with a baby on the way. But like, like the show doesn't talk about that at all.
She probably realized she didn't want anything to do with this dude either, so...
Well, actually, what happens is, this is when he starts raping women, and in fact, on April 10th of 1963, he raped and attempted to murder a woman by stabbing her in the back with scissors.
Oh, gosh.
Uh-huh. She survived, and he is sentenced to 40 years in prison.
Oh.
Well, but clearly that...
That doesn't happen, clearly, but yeah, so what happened there?
So on the Cold Case File show, they say that he joined a group in 1972 that taught him how to be an EMT, which I'm like, what the fuck? Why would we teach a sexual predator? Why?
Wait, why? Why? Why give don't him know. Anything?
Don't understand that. Why anytime but. Of day? Then he was released in 1976 after just 13 years served because they didn't think he was a danger anymore.
After 13 years?
After 13 years raping multiple women and trying to murder one of them.
Yeah, 13 years. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. The reform is not there.
No. No, it's not.
Not at all. Okay, so.
Yeah. So then, according to the show... He immediately moved to Carbondale and applied for the SIU ambulance service and was hired. But then there's articles that say that he was actually attending SIU, but that he also worked as an EMT. So, like...
Why does he even get a job that has to do with anything helping human beings?
Because do we not clearly, do background checks?
Right. Probably not, I guess, in the 80s.
I mean, I guess it was 82, but yeah.
Still.
What were you doing for the last 13 years? You were in prison. Oh, yeah. Sounds great. Let's hire you.
We would like to have this felon on board with
vulnerable people.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, like, apparently Eccles then also finds that on February 20th of 1979, he was actually arrested again for indecent liberties with a child.
What the hell does that mean? I mean, we know what it means, but why is he even still walking the streets?
Right. Who knows? He's actually the first person in the history of Jackson County to be certified as sexually dangerous, but like clearly not dangerous enough because they make him do some counseling and then he's released in 1981 to prove that he's cured. So like,
that's how they prove it, just by letting him out into the world. Like,
I guess
that sounds smart. Okay.
So like, I mean, yeah, I'm like, okay, fuck these dudes who decided that because... Yeah,
he's just going to always be like, it's fine, I'll do something and I'll take a class and then they'll think I'm fine and I'll go back and do it again.
Right. I was like, you're clearly not good counselors or therapists or whatever.
No.
Yeah. So because we know clearly he went on to murder at least three other women.
Jeez.
Then it turns out, so like when Eccles goes to like find him, turns out he's in jail. Because in 1988, he was arrested again for three other sexual assaults, and he is currently serving time in, like, I think they said Ira, Illinois, at a correctional facility. I'm like, that sounds less bad than prison.
Yeah, it sure does. Like, he obviously doesn't care. Like, he literally, after he keeps recommitting crimes, why are they even letting him out?
I don't No, and I don't know actually like how much time he was supposed to serve for that. Like if he would have gotten out if they hadn't gotten his DNA.
Right.
So on August 21st of 2007, Eccles travels to the correctional facility he's being held in because I guess it's not that far from Carbondale. And Kreischer denied it. Like, even with the DNA evidence, he's like, nope, wasn't me. Didn't do it. You got the wrong person.
I would maybe believe that a little more if there wasn't this big back history here. You have a long rap sheet, bro.
Yeah. You're in prison for sexual assault, dude. Yeah. So the next morning, Eccles gets back into work and he has a voicemail from the lieutenant from the correctional facility saying, hey, JK, Eccles actually wants you to come back because he wants to confess. Or Kreischer does. So Eccles is happy about this because he was trying to get him to confess because he's like, I know we have the evidence that if we go to trial, he's going to be convicted. But he didn't want to have to put the family through that trial.
No.
They still have the opportunity, like, you know, there's still a sentencing hearing that, you know, they can give their victim impact statements to and stuff. But that's different than going through the full trial, right? Oh, yeah, you know, and trying to listen to like a defense, giving excuses and shit.
Yeah.
So the detective calls Deborah's dad, Bernie, tells him everything. And like, Bernie talks about how like, he's not happy. Like, I mean, he's like, he's glad there's going to be justice, but it, I mean, his daughter's still dead and she died a horrific death.
Like nothing is going to bring her back regardless. So.
Right. So then on August 31st of 2007, which then that's my mom's birthday. I'm like,
weird.
I know, so many weird dates. But the detective from the Cape, Girardeau, calls Eccles and he's like, hey, so I saw this. Do you think that this guy is connected to Marjorie and Mildred's cases? And like they interviewed, I guess, Kreischer's cellmate and stuff. And it makes it likely that he was there at the time. Now, they have some DNA and a partial palm print from one of the scenes from Margie and Mildred. So they're like running all that and it sounds like it's matching. And now I'm not exactly sure how they come across this information. But they somehow end up with a list of other victims of Kreischer's. And so I'm going to go down the timeline because Margie wasn't actually the first murder victim.
Oh.
So the first was actually a double homicide on August 12th of 1977 of 58-year-old Brenda Parsh and her 27-year-old daughter, Mary Parsh, who were both sexually assaulted and murdered. And they were in Cape Girardeau as well, which I'm like, how did we not, like, I get that it was a few years later, but how did we not maybe connect these
two, because
they were tied up and naked on the bed as well. Oh. I want to say that these two women were shot. I would still think.
Especially that with it not being solved either. I mean,
yes.
Start looking for the similarities.
Yes. And then we had on November 16th of 1977 was she, 21-year-old Sheila Cole. And she was also from Cape Girardeau, but she was actually killed in Illinois. I'm not sure where. Then on May 12th of 78, we had 51-year-old Virginia Witt in Marion, Illinois. And then we had on March 22nd of 79, 29-year-old Joyce Tharp. I want to say she was black as well. She was from Kentucky, but she was killed in Illinois.
Jeez.
And then on April 16th of 79, we had 51-year-old Myrtle Rip in Pennsylvania. And then it was followed by Margie, Deborah, and Mildred.
Jeez.
So both of these detectives speak to Kreischer on November 14th of 2007, but he denies Margie and Mildred because Missouri has the death penalty and Illinois doesn't. So detectives end up talking to the victim's family about making a deal where they take the death penalty off the table in order to get him to confess. And they all agree.
Yeah.
So on December 3rd of 2007, Kreischer finally confesses. He admits to all of those murders. And he says that he didn't know any of them. There was never a rhyme or reason to it. He just looked for easy targets. He would follow them usually from parking lots and follow them home, see if a man lived there, and then come back like a week later. So
jeez.
He does also admit to about 20 other burglaries, rapes, and attempted murder. Like there was, I guess, an attempted murder that led to a false conviction in 1981 for someone else.
Wow.
Yeah. And so this is where, too, I just want to say there were several other, like, sexual assault victims who did survive. Like, there was one woman I read who he grabbed her in a Walmart parking lot, and she had a 5-year-old child with her. And he left the child in the car, and he, like, assaulted her, but he left them both. And I'm not, like, there was a lot of details, and we could have gone into details about all these other victims, but I didn't want it to seem like we were discussing these things just for the sake of the shock and horror of it. I really wanted to focus on the fact that, like, I feel like if this wasn't for Deborah's case, there is a good possibility that those other murders would have continued to go unsolved. So that's why I kind of focused it the way I did. But so on April 4th of 2008, he was sentenced to 13 life sentences without the possibility of parole. And like I said, I just feel like if it hadn't been for Deborah and that case and them looking at that DNA, like, who knows if any one of those other ones would have ever done that.
That's crazy. So how many in total he admitted to? 13 at least?
So there was a total of, what was it, like 9 victims total. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So 9 murder victims in total. But then he said there was another 20 unsolved between burglaries, rapes. There was probably a lot more sexual assaults.
So how did they give him 13 life sentences?
I think some of them got multiple just because of, like, how he did it and stuff like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gosh. So it was 9 for 9 women. He got 13 total.
Yeah, buddy. Try getting out now with that. Gosh. Mm-hmm.
But then it just
thought deep down he was going to get out at some point too.
Well, like, and they talk about how, because, like, they show on Cold Case Files bits of the interview, and he is just very, like, you know, like, this one reporter's like, most serial killers want to brag about this. He was just matter of fact, kind of monotone, was just like, this is how I did it. This is what I did. This is where, you know, what led up to it. And, like, he never gave a reasoning. Like, they were like, but why? And he was like, you wouldn't get it. Like, I'm different from other people. And it's like,
yeah, you needed help clearly and did not get the help.
You should have never been released from prison. And it just goes to show, like, especially with sexual assault, how much more, like, even today in 2024, like, we still need better punishments for those types of crimes. Like, but I'm like, you even had attempted murder and you were like, 13 years is enough. Yeah. Yeah.
13 is not nearly long enough.
You sexually assaulted a child? 2 years is fine.
And, like, sexual crimes like that, they generally don't change. Like, they're not reformed. They don't come out and suddenly not have the urge to act on that.
No.
Like, sorry, but that's probably not a
wise you're going to have to do some very intensive therapy. And you're probably going to have to, like, if you have any, I don't even know. Like, yeah, it's sickening, though. But I'm like, none of this should have happened, especially. Like, I get that prior to being released in 1981, he had already murdered some people, which he shouldn't have. But it's like, especially those last few should have never happened because he should have stayed in prison.
Yep.
Like, how do you not look at the past? I'm like, oh, hey, you sexually assaulted people before and you tried to kill one and then you just did it to a child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, maybe more than 3 years. Maybe you don't get out.
And you would think, like, after more and more cases like this happen and they see these patterns and what happens, you would think the justice system would somehow learn from it and change. And I hope they will at some point. Like,
right.
But my gosh, like, right now, it's scary because it's like, oh, overcrowding is an issue. And so I think they're so quick to just be like, oh, they're changed. They can go out, you know, like, and that's alarming to me. Like, cool. It is. Do I want more prisons? No, but I also would like to not have to be in fear. So.
Let's also, like, not make small amounts of weed be such harsh charges.
Right.
Like, maybe let's go and look at that priorities. And, like, release the people who are in there for, like, having a little bit of weed on them.
Yeah. So what? They smoked a little weed, you know, like,
yeah,
I agree. I think that's a bit much. I mean, especially when it comes to overcrowding. If that's the case, then maybe look at that stuff, the less serious things. So,
yeah. But that's, like, what's so disgusting and, you know, kind of not hopeful for even today is, like, there's a TikTok person I follow who's, like, he's always, like, lessons in not crossing a gay man. He's hilarious. Mm-hmm. But he has a goddaughter who's, like, 13, maybe. She's a young teen. Mm-hmm. He just talked about how the fact that she's currently going through some stuff because she stayed the night at a friend's house and the friend's dad assaulted her. And his defense was that she was wearing short shorts. Mm-mm. And he, like, it's human nature.
No, that is exactly why we do not do
no. sleepovers. And I'm like, how is a defense attorney? Can you live with yourself and speak those words out of your mouth?
Do you have a daughter yourself or children?
Because that means he's admitting that he did it. Mm-hmm. But you're trying to justify why he did.
That's gross. Disgusting. So disgusting.
Gross.
Yeah. Wow.
It's sickening. And the fact that we still go through this shit in 2024, is gross to me. Like, it doesn't matter what a woman could be passed out naked. That doesn't give you any right to sexually assault her.
No, sure doesn't. And on that note, we can still talk about your case, but I'm just tying in my fact here because it kind of goes along with this, which I don't know how accurate this is, but it says most people walk past at least 36 serial killers in their lifetime. That's a 36 seem a little high, but that also
seems excessive.
I agree. And so I'm like, I mean, I get cereal. They technically say if it's more than one or
I think it's
more than one or two,
three. Isn't it? It doesn't have to be at least
something
three.
Like that. I was surprised. I was like, I don't know, but
I don't know.
That's kind of 30? Alarming too. But then you think about cases like this and you're like, well, he was killing people left and right. And nobody knew. Was. So
but I mean today though,
maybe not as much today. Maybe too.
Cause I feel like they catch serial killers.
Yeah.
So hard to get away with it now.
I know. Maybe they're not serial killers, but you're definitely walking past someone who's probably assaulted somebody.
Oh, 100%.
We'll just change it to that. But gross and scary. You can't do anything or go anywhere. So.
No, that's why I like to just be a homebody.
Yeah, same. And judge from afar. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But really, you just never know what's going on. So.
Yeah. No, that's, oh my goodness. Yeah. So that's this week's case. I know it's
believe I never heard of that guy. That's a lot of people he killed.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe just because it is an older one, but I'm surprised I didn't hear about that when it
I was going to say, 2006, 2007.
But still, I guess, news, you pretty much had to sit down and watch it. It still wasn't, as easy to just get in your hand as it is now. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's part of it. But that's wild. And now I'm going to have to go check out that guy because I'm curious. Just, I need to look at him. Oh, God. He's a creep.
I know. I'm going to try to just post pictures of the victims. I'm going to see if I can find images of all of the murder victims. Hopefully, I know I can find some of Deborah and Margie and Mildred, but I'm hoping I can find some of the other women as well. And I'm not even going to post his picture. He's gross. You can see him.
He's disgusting. Mm-hmm. I see something with six other pictures I can send you if you don't.
Yeah, that'd be great. Just so I have a starting point. But it is just, it's something. It's definitely,
wild.
I said, yeah.
So there were Illinois, right?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, that's pretty wild. Did not know that one. And that's sad. Deborah's beautiful.
I know. And it's just she had so many hopes and dreams and she wanted a family of her own one day. And
just pisses you off, the more it's sad, but it's also just enraging. I could just.
And the thing is, and that's the other thing. That's what threw them off and why some of these cases weren't connected because it was different. There was no rhyme or reason to the women. A lot of times it's usually a specific type they kill in a certain way, but he just did whatever was easy and convenient.
He did not care
how old, their skin color. He would kill them in whatever way was easy.
How old they were.
Yeah. Cause I think maybe a few of the victims might've been stabbed as well. So it's just, that's almost one of those, I can understand why some of them, like I said, the Cape Girardeau, I'm probably saying that town's wrong, but the Parche women and then these other two, I'm 77 to 82 is only, 5 years?
Yeah.
Like, how did we not, like, as soon as it happened, were you, how did we not go back? Like, oh my God, this is exactly like the Parrish murders.
Right.
It's a small town.
In a small town, something like that shakes the community. So when it happens again.
Yeah.
You're like, wait a minute.
How did we not?
Remember when this happened also a couple years ago or whatever? Yeah. Like.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And maybe they did, but like.
I mean, maybe they didn't just really talk about it. Yeah.
Differences. They were like, nah, nah.
Yeah.
Which is stupid too, because.
I know.
Just because that's a great way for someone to get away with things is switching it up, because then they don't. But like, are they not dumb? It's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, cool. Not cool, but.
I mean, yeah, I know what you mean.
That's wild.
Yeah, so that's this week's case. Like I said, I really wanted to focus on that. Like I said, Deborah mainly too, just because not that the other victims aren't important and don't matter by any means, but it is also Black History Month. I wanted to focus on a Black victim. And I just thought, like, at least there was some good that came out of her death and helping to catch this person. So
for sure. Yeah, that is very true. Well, bless her little heart. That's sad.
And now, you know, you guys, just be wary of every single person you pass when you're in the store, because they're potentially a serial killer.
Yeah, apparently 36 of them. That's like way high. That's why when I was like, I don't know about this, but I actually saw this on two different spots. And so that's why I was like, well.
I wonder how they figure that, though. It's like when they said.
And how
like,
would you whole, know?
Like, right. Like the whole, like the average human eats like what, 8 spiders a year or like whatever that is, which I think that's come out finally as them saying that's not true, but like.
Yeah, that's definitely, we're going to say not true because I don't want that to be true. I know.
But I'm always curious, really, like, how do you figure? Like, because.
I know.
Who's taking the time? Like, even for the like serial killers who were caught, like, here's all the people you may have walked by.
Get,
like, I just, I don't get it.
Just, and that's a high number. Like, I believe there is scum out there and people have killed people, but like, that seems like a high amount, especially now though. I mean, maybe like more in the 70s and before
70s
that.
When it was like serial killer central.
Yeah. Like you could,
that was the age of serial killers.
That was the
killers.
Time. If you were going to be a serial killer, you should have been born in that.
Yeah.
That time, because that's the way you could get out of it.
But, speaking of serial killers, though, did I ever tell you about the book I read while I listened to it, which the audiobook was phenomenal, called Butcher and Blackbird? Okay, I'm going to tell you all about it right now. Listen, first of all, it's a spicy book, okay?
Oh.
We got some spice to it, but it's about two serial killers who kill killers.
Kind of like Dexter?
Yes. Okay. But they happen to meet, then they invent a game to try to, like, they meet up once a year to kill a killer. And, like, they have to discover who it is. Like, his brother picks someone for them.
Oh.
And then they do it. So, like, there is a few gory-esque points. Nothing horrible. I never thought it was, like, super gross. I've seen people talk about reading it and being like, meh. I personally think the audiobook narration, which I can give you my Audible login if you want to listen to it.
Yeah,
ever.
I need to do that.
Because, first of all, the male narrator has an Irish accent. It is.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And then the back and forth between them, because a lot of times what they'll do with stuff like that, because chapters switch point of view between him and her.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they'll then have them voice the other person. They don't in this. So like she throughout, like if they're talking to each other, they both voice their characters.
Oh, I like that better.
So
I struggle sometimes with audiobooks because
I'll give you my login so you can check this one out, see what you think. I listened to it. It's an 8-hour audiobook. I listened to it in one whole day. I couldn't stop listening. It was fun. Book 2 comes out this year.
Oh, so it's a series. What did you say it was called?
It's called Butcher and Blackbird.
Okay. I'll have to look at it just to see.
So for those of you who like I know we haven't really been doing that, but I was like, this kind of ties in slightly and lets us end on a light note too.
Yes.
It's a slow burn, but the spice is spicy.
Oh yeah. By Bryn Weaver.
Yes.
Or I don't know if that's how she would say it, but okay.
Yeah.
I'm putting it
the next book's going to be called Leather and Lark, about her friend and his brother.
Interesting.
I was really excited.
Currently reading this book, so okay, add it to the list.
Yeah,
that's fun.
Yeah, it was. So
on that note, not the same, but sort of, I did an escape room this past weekend, and it was one called like Off Limits. And the whole thing was like, you're at a house party with your kind of weird coworker who's sketch, and he's having you guys all over for dinner. He tells you not to go in this room. You go into the room, of course. And also, previous to that whole thing, I guess I should say, one of your coworkers has gone missing recently. So you guys are all just like together. So it was intense because I was kind of like, well, when we signed up to do it, the warnings, like on the thing, it said warning graphic content. And I was like, what the hell? So not, you know, whatever. Yeah. We have a good escape room. So we do all the clues and you're in this creepy ass room. And, you know, there's this part where you, I don't know, once you type in the code to something, it pops open this other room and you walk in and it's like a freaking kill room straight out of Dexter. Plastic everywhere.
Oh my
then God. Over they have a cooler and they have, well, obviously, you know, not real body parts, but they have a body, pieces yeah. of a body laying out in a cooler and all this shit. And it was like, ooh, it felt so fun. Like, I was like, this is sick that I'm so excited about this right now. Like, I was like, this takes all my little dreams to where they want to be with like solving a crime. And I was like, right? Ooh, this is dark and twisty. Then you find the head in a separate thing. Oh my God. And like, yeah, it was legit. So I'm just all in my killer. I'm not feeling homicidal.
Right.
So
right.
No worries there, everybody. But I enjoy a good mystery to solve. Let's just say that. So.
Yes, I hear that.
But yeah.
All right. Well, maybe on that note, before we get too much weirder.
Yeah, guys, we're not that weird. We just like fun mysteries, you know, to solve than thrillers.
That's fine. But
when it's fun and games.
Yeah. So you guys know the drill. Follow us on the socials. Share, rate, review, like, do all those things. It helps us out. All that's linked in the show notes. And until next time, stay Heartland kind.
But Darkland wary.